Hello, everyone, and welcome to the Literacy View. We actually have a breaking news episode. We have APM journalist Christopher Peek. Yay! This is so exciting. If those of you have been living under a rock, maybe you don't know, but Christopher Peek was a co-investigative reporter of Sold a Story. And he joins us to discuss his three April articles about the collapse of the literacy giants. And that is Reading Recovery, Fontes and Pinnell, and TC Reading and Writing Project, along with Heinemann Publishing. So let me give you a little background about Christopher. Christopher Peek is an investigative reporter who covers education for APM Reports. He co-reported Sold a Story, a podcast about a disproven approach to teaching reading used in many elementary schools. The series was one of Apple's most shared podcasts in 2023. It won a DuPont Columbia, a National Edward R. Murrow Award, an IRE Award, a Third Coast Award, and two Scripps Howard Awards, and it was nominated for a Peabody. Following its release, at least 16 states passed new laws about reading instruction, and school districts nationwide, including New York City, announced they would no longer use programs covered in the podcast. Peek previously covered schools for the New Haven Independent. He was a finalist for the Education Writers Association's National Award for Beat Reporting, and he won numerous regional awards, including Connecticut SPJ's First Amendment Award. Peek has also written for Nation Swell, The Point Raised Light, Newsday, and the San Francisco Public Press. And we are so happy to have Christopher Peek here with us today. So, Christopher,
I'm so happy to be here.
Oh, me too. I'm just so happy to do this. Judy and I, my co-host Judy Boxter and I have been looking so forward to this. By the way, for any of you out there, my name is Faith Borkowski, and Judy and I have just celebrated our 2-year anniversary of this podcast. And what better way to celebrate than with Christopher, who is also a New York City resident. And so we are so excited to be here with you. So here's my first thought, Christopher, before we even get into your three amazing articles. What got you into reporting?
That's a good question. I initially wanted to be a poet, and I realized there was no way to actually live on that. So I was involved in arts and photography, and I started taking pictures for the college newspaper, and then found out that I just loved it so much to be able to experience the world, go out, and I have an excuse. I'm very nosy, you could say, and just have an excuse to talk to people and learn about what motivates them and the issues that are on their mind. And it's just a joy every day to get to be paid to be curious and to help sate other people's curiosities, especially about education, which I just love so much. And that's kind of what I spent the bulk of my career so far covering.
It's funny. That's exactly what I wanted to know. Education in general, how you got into this aspect of reporting. But as you said, you're interested and curious. So my co-host, Judy Boxner, is very curious, and she has some questions, as do I. But I'm going to start off with Judula. Go ahead.
Oh my God, you wanted me to ask him a question? Okay.
Yes, so go ahead.
You mentioned Connecticut. You know, I now reside in Connecticut. I'm originally a Brooklyn girl that's been in Connecticut for 13 years. You also mentioned New Haven. Did you live there for a while?
I did, yeah. I was covering the schools for about 3 years there.
That's pretty amazing. Okay, so in regards to something other than schools, Pepe's or Sally's, what's your favorite pizza?
So I lived across the street from Pepe's.
Oh, Pepe's.
Sally's being a block away, so it was not that far. But so I do have my like special order from Pepe's. And the nice thing was I didn't have to wait in that line because I would just order takeout and then walk across the street.
Oh my God. But anybody listening and you're not familiar with New Haven, Connecticut pizza,
it is the capital of the world, I think.
The pizza capital of the world, even though I have to say Brooklyn's in the house. And I think Brooklyn has a pretty good slice. But and there's this big war between Pepe's and Sally's on the same block.
It sounds like the reading wars. Faith, it sounds
I know, right? Irresolvable.
I didn't hear, Judy. What did you say?
It's a little bit like the reading wars, no?
I think so. It's like the reading wars, the pizza wars. So go ahead, Judy. Ask your first question.
All right. So before we even start, I'm curious, what are some future projects you're working on? What's next for Christopher?
That's a good question. We are just starting to talk about that. This was kind of the end of season one, about everything that's happened with this three queuing idea that we investigated and really the fallout, the way that everyone's reacting. And so we're starting to pivot to season two and stay tuned. It takes us a little while to get to these things, because we do our homework. But we're just starting to plan that out now.
We're excited about this thing.
Oh, I can see that. That was very cryptic, Christopher. I'm going to call you Christopher Cryptic.
I was trying to be nosy. I'm really good.
I know, but he's not giving you a thing. So go ahead, ask about these articles, Judy.
Hey, you go. You're the
okay. I'm going to go. All right.
I'm going to take this up in my seltzer. Faith. This is my seltzer. And I know it looks tacky drinking seltzer online. So Faith, on behalf of my birthday, just sent me a new purple mug. And my seltzer is now in a mug. There's no coffee in here. So here I go.
Okay. So I'll kick off, Christopher. You have three articles that all came out in April. So April showers not only bring May flowers, but it brings, you know, a lot of information here. So the first article out of the three was really about the universities, how Ohio and Lesley are kind of just doubling down. They're not really changing anything. How did you find this out if they're not giving you a thing? It didn't seem like they were going to give you one thing. So tell us how you dug up some dirt.
Well, I should give credit to Leslie because they were actually quite open and they did arrange an interview with us. So that is hard to do. So they do deserve a lot of credit for that, of saying, here's what we believe. And we're willing to talk to the people who we've listened to the podcast. We know you don't love our ideas about these things. So they do get credit. But I had sent Ohio State's a public university. So I'd sent public records requests to them, and you're able to get some information through that. And then there were these other public records about where Gay Sue Pinnell's money has gone, because she was directing a lot of it through her foundation. So you could see where some of those transactions occurred. But so I got to sit down with the provost at Lesley, where Irene Fountas still directs the Center for Literacy Collaborative and Reading Recovery. They're training, I think it's about a dozen districts, primarily in New England, to continue to do reading recovery, to do a lot of Fountas and Pinnell's methods, whether that's leveled literacy intervention or assessing kids with the benchmark assessment system. And she basically said, you know, we need this to be an option for schools. There are schools that still believe in balanced literacy, that still use these methods, that have reading recovery, and it would be a disservice to not train them. They said that the three queuing MSV is an idea that some people believe in, and so they thought we just shouldn't eradicate that. Ohio State was a little bit harder to get answers from, but in both of these cases, they're getting a lot of money from Gay Sue Pinnell at both universities, totaling about, I think it was more than $10 million between the two of them to support these programs and have be out there and name chairs after Gay and Mari Clay. So there is a monetary incentive for them to continue these programs. They're being externally funded, so it's not taking a chunk out of their budget. And like at Lesley, they feel like they need it. And this is happening all as states are really cracking down in Ohio. They're banning three queuing. They're essentially getting rid of reading recovery in these schools, and yet you still have the state-funded university teaching teachers this. They don't really do it as much in the pre-service program, which is a little bizarre, but then as soon as you get in the classroom, you can get trained to be a reading recovery teacher. So it's a little bit of a disconnect there.
Hmm. So these programs are a real cash cow. So not only are they being funded, it means a lot to the college, but on top of it, education programs in general are real cash cows for universities.
And this one, I don't know how much they're profiting from district contracts, but certainly when Gay Supinel's $1 million donations are coming in, I think that's a fair thing to say.
Yeah, I would say so.
And this is happening too, as Teachers College is doing the opposite. So there's an alternative here. Teachers College is making probably just as much money, if not more, from Lucy Calkins trainings, and they decided to change course anyway. So this is not, you know, just because we have a donor who says that they want this, you need to go ahead and stick with these ideas. There is another alternative, and Teachers College Reading Writing Project arguably is even more prominent, was out there bringing in more money for the college. And they said, you know what, we're transitioning to something else. Now, at the same time, you could be cynical and say maybe they're doing that because people are changing their views on all of those methods and they were losing contracts and they needed to keep the money coming. But that might be a little bit too cynical, and we don't have reporting to suggest that's necessarily what's happening. But there is another way that these colleges could be approaching how they're teaching reading, both to their pre-service teachers and the ones who are actually on the job, which doesn't get covered as much.
Yeah, it's very interesting to kind of see the contrast, really, about, you know, how these universities are handling it. Judy, any thoughts about Lucy? We could drink to Lucy. about how Lucy started Mossflower, and she's going into a private direction while Ohio State. Oh, I'm getting some feedback. While Ohio State is holding on to this and not changing.
So, you know, Faith, my general philosophy is I personally don't love to name people's names. I think the problem, as I've stated many, many times, was way beyond just, let me say it, Lucy. I think it was a big systematic problem nationwide, worldwide, because reading recovery wasn't just big in the United States. It was big in Australia, New Zealand, other places as well. I think basically we had a system that was failing for kids for a very long time. I myself, as you all know, was formally trained in reading recovery in 2013. When I first started teaching in the year 2000, phonics was just making its way out and the balanced literacy world was making its way in big time. 2013, I was asked to be trained in reading recovery. I was shocked that I was being asked something like that. I cried because I didn't like change. I loved being in the classroom. But then everybody around me convinced me that this was the golden ticket to success and the best thing that I could do for kids at that time. So 24 hours later, I made my decision and I jumped. Now, you know, I had some success with some students. It was kind of exciting. I learned a lot of things. I got a lot of feedback. There was a lot of professional training and so forth. But deep in my gut, I knew that a good amount of the students that I myself was working with weren't making adequate progress. Especially kids that I was working with in the second round of reading recovery, which were usually the more struggling learners. They were looking at the initial letter of words, and that's what I was telling them to do. Get your mouth ready, get your mouth ready. I was drawing pictures of lips all over the place, and kids were cross-checking back and forth and looking at the picture. And looking back now, that was definitely not the best course of action for kids. I didn't teach kids how to decode really well. And I think that a majority of the people in our nation and other nations, we failed the kids for a very long time. And we had research and data to support that that wasn't the best course of action. And schools had terrible data for a very long time, including schools that I actually worked with in the past. And we didn't do anything. It took a very long time for the tide to shift. So, you know, I kind of applaud that people are shifting and, you know, teachers' college is shifting. And I saw Lucy at the Everyone Reads conference in Manhattan. But I don't know. A, I don't know what people's intentions are. Is it to make an extra buck, or is it because people are really internalizing that, yes, there were many things that were successful and probably aligned to the science, but there were many fundamental flaws. And I don't know if people are taking enough time. I think many people are. I've taken 7 years now, to 7 or 8 years, to evolve in the structured literacy world because I know I need to do better and help more kids. But is everybody doing that? And what disappoints me is that, you know, many universities have a great platform, and when they are holding on so tight to beliefs rather than what works for children based on evidence and research, that's really concerning. And I want to say thank Christopher. You know, everybody in the world, we know Emily is a big part of, you know, the reporting. But, you know, Christopher, you've been a really big part of informing everybody about this too. And I'm so honored to finally see the man behind all those brilliant articles that are so honest. You are definitely, I don't know you well yet, but I look forward to getting to know. I think he's a no BS bestie.
I think so. So Christopher,
Thank you. That's really sweet of you, Judy.
Judy said so much, and it's so interesting. So I actually had a follow-up, but now that Judy said this and mentioned the Soldier story, what was your role in this? Do you have separate roles as reporters? Were you the investigator? Like, how did this break out in terms of responsibilities, roles and responsibilities? That's fascinating to me, actually, because clearly after I see the articles that came out in April for APM, and you're the lead writer here, clearly you are extremely talented and need to get recognized. And so what is your role? What was your role in Soldier Story?
Yeah, so I started on the team in 2020, and Emily had been covering reading before. I was a huge fan of hers. I was listening to the podcast as I was covering what was going on in New Haven, and I started to see some of these examples of, I think her documentary about queuing had just come out, and I was seeing it happen in New Haven. I went to this one school that was really low performing. They were trying to do a turnaround, and they had this event for parents to come in and help their kids. And this one mom showed up and said, I have a seventh grader who really is struggling to read. He's confusing his words, and I just don't want this to happen again to my little daughter. And they taught her, this is great. We're so glad you're here. Here's picture power. Here's all the different powers associated with Lucy Calkins methods. And then they said, and take some of these leveled books home. And not that those are necessarily bad for a parent to be using, but it was like, here's my city. Here's my neighborhood. Here's my my building, which is just, you know, you don't expect a kid to decode those things. And I was being told is, you know, here's how to get it right, even though it seemed like her older son had already been a casualty of that. So I was on this topic. I was just starting to dig into it and buy some books. And then I got an interview with APM Reports and joined there. And so Emily is a fantastic radio reporter and really did a lot of the work of making Soldier Story so compelling, because she's an expert at that. And I came from a print background of doing investigations, so I helped bring in the more of the work with getting the documents and finding people to talk to who, you know, weren't necessarily the main characters here on the radio, but were the ones who provided the backbone of what was really going on. So I focused primarily on the company, on Heinemann, who had been the kind of centerpiece for a lot of these authors who were so influential, and try to figure out what's going on inside there and how they were so successful.
Fascinating. I don't know if you know, but Emily Hanford interviewed me and for her articles that came out. And she had interviewed me about my first book, Reading Intervention Behind School Walls, Why Your Child Continues to Struggle. And then that was republished as Failing Students or Failing Schools. And so my book actually was about my story. And so I went through all this organically and as a teacher. So it was very interesting when the reporting did come out, how much of it resonated with me and my work and my book and everything. It was interesting to see. So getting back to the articles, I never gave the name of that first article that I just started with. So let me say that right now. It was April 4th, and that was as states refocus reading instruction, two universities stick with a discredited idea. And we were talking about Ohio State University and Lesley. That's where we started. And then Judy started to get into her reading recovery background. And the article that came out on April 11th was Reading Recovery Organization Confronts Financial Difficulties. Let's jump into that one, okay, since Judy mentioned reading recovery. So in the article, I couldn't help but see that you came up with a number that 92% of kids who have gone through reading recovery later on still were not recovered in some way, shape, or form. You know, could you
talk? I was just in one district.
That was in one district that it was 92%, because that's stunning. You know, I think that it could vary. It depends maybe in certain districts or having, you know, different people doing it. Maybe the numbers were higher. But whether it's 92% failure or 50% failure, that's pretty high. You know, either way, that it was not really recovering the kids who needed to be recovered in first grade. Could you talk a little bit about what's going on with reading recovery now, Christopher?
Yeah, and I'm so curious to hear Judy talk about this too. I'm just pulling up the numbers for nationally. The number of kids who didn't complete reading recovery, so the way they categorize things is a little bit different than what that one district was looking at, but 23% of kids don't complete reading recovery nationally. Another 15% are recommended for further remediation afterwards. So it's not 95% across the country, but this is Reading Recovery Zone numbers. About, what would that be, 38% of kids, you know, are not fully succeeding even by their own metrics. But so this article is about the Reading Recovery Council of North America, which is this nonprofit organization that's essentially like the professional association for reading recovery trainers and teachers. They're going out there lobbying, advocating for reading recovery to be in schools, to get grant funding from states or nonprofits. And the organization is kind of falling apart. At least when you look at their tax records, they are overspending for the last couple of years. And I got to talk to their former chief financial officer, who'd been there for 22 years, running their books, trying to get them balanced. And he was saying that if it weren't for this big donation they got from Gay Sue Pennell, that they probably would have been gone already. And that at this point, she really is the Reading Recovery Council of North America. Because without her big donations, they just wouldn't have any cash left in the bank. So they spent a lot of that money, we found out from this chief financial officer, on an ad campaign to rebut our reporting, and are now putting some of the money into a lawsuit too against the state of Ohio to try to overturn their queuing ban. So he was questioning, you know, this organization was founded really to support teacher training in reading recovery, to get this intervention to more kids. Is this really the best use of funds to be going after our critics? Maybe arguably it's existential for them. They do need to come after us, but at this point you can see their reserves are dwindling, and they are beset on all sides in their minds by legislators and journalists who are coming after them. And they're trying to do what they can to kind of make a last stand in their defense.
Christopher, did you see our episode that just came out on reading recovery?
It's in my podcast. You didn't get a chance to listen to it yet.
Okay. It was based on their article, their Reading Recovery Journal article that just came out spring 2024. So anybody who's listening now, if you're interested in this, we had a real juicy episode about that article where we had an ex-reading recovery teacher turned structured literacy teacher on with an education attorney. So I know you wanted to hear
from me. So we had two reading recovery teachers on.
That's, That's right.
That's a lot. Yeah.
Exactly. So, Judy, I know Christopher wanted to hear from you. Any thoughts about the Reading Recovery article that he had written? Any thoughts that you have?
So, Christopher, you said you wanted to hear my thoughts on something. So I opened the
floor. Yeah, I was just curious about what the Reading Recovery Council was to you, if anything. You know, just because this nonprofit goes away doesn't mean that Reading Recovery would necessarily go away. But one of the complaints I heard from the chief financial officer was that he felt like they didn't offer enough to members to get them to be like, oh, I'm proud to be an RRCNA council member, and so I need to keep paying my dues every year. So I was just curious about when you were big on Reading Recovery, what was the council to you, if anything?
So that's an interesting question. So even like on social media, like I'll see a lot of these people that kind of like represent Reading Recovery. I didn't really know a lot about them, to be quite honest. Like, and I'm not going to name names, but everybody knows those names. The PT name, the BM name, there's another one. There's a couple of people out there, Dr. Sam. I didn't know any of them. Basically, during that time in my life, like many other Reading Recovery people, we were a tight-knit bunch of teachers. We were pretty passionate people. We had to give up every Wednesday night. We were really mostly in it to win it and help kids, and that's really what most of us were thinking about. We knew that RRCNA was like available to us and we were happy about it, but it wasn't like our end all be all. I remember like going on it a couple of times to just print out some like templates and so forth. But I don't think that, you know, I was that fascinated even with like Lucy Calkins, because like Lucy Calkins basically, from what it seemed like back then, just, oh yeah, I said it. Let me get a seltzer. You know, she just like took things that were intended for a different purpose and marketed and made it her own. So, you know, when Reading Recovery was designed, I think that my personal opinion is I think there were some good intentions. And I think some of the things that were happening in Reading Recovery were so positive. I mean, people watched how I taught. Now, was I doing the best job behind the glass? No. But as Faith said in our last recording, that's a pretty powerful model. And I don't see that model anywhere where you're vulnerable enough as a teacher to be behind glass. You have your colleagues watching you teach. You have principals watching you teach. And then you discuss it and get feedback on the spot. That's powerful. Now, I would love to do that same model now using decodable texts, having kids sound out words, seeing kids sliding through words at points of difficulty and making the sounds. And then, of course, integrating MSV eventually when they need to integrate all those sources. Because of course, the goal of reading is meaning, right?
The goal, the initial goal, not starting off.
Right. And going back. And it doesn't mean that meaning doesn't exist in the early stages. But the problem with the whole MSV thing was we were telling these early readers so many things when their first course of action based on the science and evidence should have been look at the letters, look at the sounds, slide through, make those sounds, and decode the word.
I'm getting tears, Judy, right now.
That's it. But instead, I was saying a lot of BS. I'm saying, does it make sense? Does it look right? The poor kid is just learning how to read. And now I'm filling their brain with so much. How could they become a successful reader if I'm not giving them the correct tools and potentially really confusing the brain? So all these people, they weren't a big part of my life. And I do have to give a shout out to a lot of Reading Recovery people like myself that have shifted. A lot of us got OG trained. A lot of us are now letters trained. So don't believe everything that you hear on social media that, you know, Reading Recovery won't let go. There's many people like myself that have shifted, made adjustments, and have embraced what's next to come. But that doesn't mean that I've let go of everything.
Yep. So, and Catherine Cook, our guest, said the same thing. So, all right. So moving on now. So we covered April 4th, April 11th, even though we'll go back. But now we're up to our most recent.
Let me ask you a question.
Yes.
Do you think that Christopher had inside information that it was our birthday month and that's why he had a trifecta of articles coming out?
I think
maybe
he's
not. We're both tourists.
Waited just for that.
I think definitely that he knew that it was our birthday month and our anniversary month of 2 years. So he did, he worked really hard to get this all in. So he just got it in April 30th. And the latest article is Science of Reading Movement Spells Financial Trouble for Publisher Heinemann. So let's get into Heinemann. You know, that is the publishing company that really is the powerhouse behind all of this, the materials, the programs, and all the big names in balanced literacy used Heinemann. And so it looks as though at the beginning they were trying to shift with the people they already used. So you mentioned some names. And it looked like there was a 2.0 type of edition of certain books that came out, the strategies, the Jennifer Saravello book. And, you know, you mentioned her by name in this article. So what do you think? Do you think people are going to forget about this and say, all right, you know what, we're going to buy these books? Or do you think they're going to remember that these were big balanced literacy people? What are your thoughts about that?
The easiest way to get something super wrong is to be a predictor of the future. So I'm a little wary of doing it. But I talked to one historian. I'll give his answer because he's studied these cycles before. And he said that when you become so closely associated with these ideas that are on the way out, that's not a good thing. That kind of spells your demise, because people are moving on to the new thing. There are these legislative mandates saying change to the new programs. I've even seen some bills that target these programs in particular, writing into the text of legislation. I don't think that particular one passed, but calling these programs out by name. So that's not a recipe for business success, to be so closely associated with the old way of doing things. So that's the historian's answer. If I were a gambling man, I think that'd probably be a safe bet that it's going to be, an uphill battle to reinvent themselves, but it's not, certainly not foreclosed. And they have had authors trying to do it. And then like Jennifer Saravello, she's moving to a new publishing house to try to publish with them. She wouldn't talk to me, so I don't know what's exactly behind that, but, I wouldn't say it's going to be easy for Heinemann.
I would imagine that, you know, when you think about it, you think about actors and they get typecast into a role. I would say Lucy, Fontenson-Pennell, Saravello, you know, pretty much if you were aligned with Heinemann for years and people just kind of connect you to balanced literacy. So that's going to be a hard transition. I would think that a lot of people out there are going to have a hard time because there are so many choices out there now. You could be buying, give me a second, Judy. You could be buying other books, other programs with people who started out either transitioning to structured literacy or have been structured literacy proponents from the beginning. Judy, what do you want to say?
A lot on my mind. I actually will challenge both of you and think I disagree a little bit. I think that there's still a lot of people out there that, based on what I'm seeing, that just will idolize people anyway. I see a lot of people who have all of a sudden entered the structured literacy world and kind of like, at least, you know, like I talk about it, right? I'm honest. I think there's a lack of honesty with a lot of people. And I think a lot of people are just following the money train and kind of like not speaking about the past. And I think ignoring the past is not okay. And you have to be brave and confident enough to say, you know, this is what was happening. This is why I shifted. Because it can't just be about profiting. It has to really be about, because this is what you believe in your heart and soul. But like, you know, so Heinemann, right? I still see SOR conferences aligning with them online. When I wake up and I open Twitter, I still see it. And then you know, I know like there's publishing companies. I think there's HMH. Aren't they tied into Heinemann?
They're the parent company.
Big, they're what? Yeah.
They're the parent company for Heinemann.
So what exactly what does that mean, parent company? So in terms of publishing, I don't know if people really understand.
Right.
Does that mean they control it? Or does that mean they just financially are under their wing? Like, what does that really mean, Christopher?
That's a great question. So Heinemann started as this little tiny company with these couple editors who came over from Britain, and they were publishing all these professional books. This was Lucy Calkins writing things like Lessons from a Child. It wasn't a curriculum, but it was kind of like, here's what I've learned from observing kids. And Jennifer Servalla was doing something similar of just, you know, this isn't necessarily a day-by-day script for you to follow, but here's kind of general approaches you can take. So that was the early Heinemann. Publishing is just like journalism, where there's always layoffs and shutdowns and mergers. So Heinemann kind of got gobbled up by all these other companies. And by the mid-2000s, they become part of Houghton Mifflin Harcourt, what eventually becomes Houghton Mifflin Harcourt. And I talked to some employees and they said that's kind of when things started to change. There wasn't this kind of almost crunchy publishing house where they had a lot of autonomy, but you started to get dictates from above about here's what the sales goals are. We need to meet these revenue targets. They still were somewhat independent. So it wasn't, it's not HMH people necessarily working hand in hand with Heinemann, but they were getting financial mandates from above. And I think that started to change even more since then. They had a big controversy in 2022, I want to say, about these critical race theory bans in a lot of states. And they were going through their programs to see, you know, do we have any mentions that are going to get us prohibited from teaching in Texas or some of these other states that had these CRT bans. And they put someone from HMH really in charge as the president of Heinemann. So they have now an HMH person overseeing the company. So I think it's even more intertwined than it was before. But so it's changed over time. They used to be a lot more autonomous back in the day. And I think HMH has increasingly had more control over Heinemann. And HMH is a company is one of the biggest educational publishers. They're huge in this market in general. So yeah, it's interesting that they kind of got disassociated. People don't connect them together. They've seen it as two different things. And what's interesting about Heinemann too, just that some nuance that I think we were mentioning, Judy, is just that so many people started emulating Heinemann. They kind of had the original thing people wanted to copy, Fountain Sentinel and Lucy. And so there were a lot of imitators, and HMH's executive just a couple of years ago was saying, we're big on balanced literacy. That's what we believe in. And now all their programs are science of reading grounded in that. And they don't know that much has changed at all. But I think everyone kind of wanted to be Heinemann. They had the original, and there were a lot of imitators, and now they're doing a quick rebranding, even though they're not doing the 2.0 version of the programs that Heinemann's trying to do.
I wonder if Christopher, you know, I don't even know when we're releasing this yet, but so the Reading League is actually, have you heard of that they've created the tool? Do you know all about
that? Yeah. Mm-hmm. I can't wait to read those.
Yeah, I thought the tool itself that they created was actually brilliant. And I think that it could definitely help schools, regardless of what program they use, have greater success. How do you feel, though, about the fact that they're releasing Faith? Could I do it?
Say whatever you want.
All right. So they're releasing some. So I thought the tool part was really awesome. How do you feel about the reports? I think they're coming out on May 1st. Everybody's waiting. Faith is not going to be around while these reports are coming out. She's going to be on a conga line somewhere. But I'm going to have to deal with it. How are you feeling about it, Christopher? Are you on pins and needles? Do you have the inside scoop? How are you feeling about this? Do you think it's legit? What do you think?
I want to read them first. I think it's good overall to have more sources of information about all these curricula. Some of these state reviews maybe are less helpful than some are better than others. But I think the more source of information out there for school leaders, the better, because I think all of us are very concerned with early literacy, but just the job of running a school district is so many more responsibilities on top of that. And there's 13,000 or so school districts out there, and they're all trying to do the same thing of what's the best reading curricula. So it's a little bit of a crazy system to have 13,000 superintendents trying to figure this out on their own. These are little tiny districts who also have to figure out what's my janitorial contract and how I'm going to feed these kids lunch and all that. So as much as I would love everyone to get as obsessed with reading and early reading instruction as we are, it's just hard task. And so I don't want to say, yeah, take the shortcut, don't do your homework. But I just think the more source of information out there that make these critiques accessible, the better. And also probably good for the publishers too, that they now have people paying attention to them. There for a long time was just, here's your big three companies, pick one of those books. Or if you want to do something alternative, you can get the Heinemann programs and build your curricula, your program of instruction up that way. So I think it's good to have people watching and saying, hey, you know, this, the way you're teaching this is not totally up to par. You need to improve it, take another look at it.
So I'm going to jump in and say something just the way Judy said, well, I disagree. I'm thinking,
Faith, what did I disagree about?
No. Before, when I had said about typecasting, you had said,
I think that we're in danger of typecasting.
Right. So I'm thinking now in terms of what Christopher is saying, I do think that if you are an elementary school principal in the primary grades, even if your degree is in something completely different, I do think it's your obligation to get with the program. And I don't mean the program. I mean, get with the program. And you have to learn the same way, Christopher, you might not have been trained as an educator. You have to educate yourself to be able to make decisions. You're in charge of kids' lives. I think it is a district responsibility and a building principal's responsibility. Before you adopt any program, you really need to investigate yourself. And yes, the reports are going to be extremely helpful, but I look at that as almost confirmation of making, you know, a decision, not looking at it and saying, okay, the Reading League said this, that's it, done deal. Because that to me is really dangerous.
Oh, I totally agree. Anytime you just say, well, it's Ed Reports approved or it's Reading League approved, that doesn't tell you much of anything. What they're pointing out might be helpful to convince your school board. You know, this is the program. Our kids really need this help. We're seeing our scores. They're lacking this component. So we really need to invest in this. I think that's where you'd want to be going to those reports for. But I totally agree. If it's Emily Hanford approved or Lucy Calkins approved, that is a dangerous path to go down, to have these people from on high dictating the way that education should go.
100%. We've talked about idol worship and the dangers of idol worship on this show multiple times. So, Judy, you had a list of questions. We have another question for our friend, our no BS bestie, Christopher.
So I myself have noticed that some people, even on the SOR side, or whatever side it is, or in the world, aren't shifting when new evidence and research comes out and making a statement. Have you noticed that? And are you just seeing a much more, what are you seeing? What are you seeing as we're shifting in terms of, like, because new evidence and research comes out often, right? That means that people have to buckle up their seatbelt and be prepared to shift. Are you seeing full evidence for that? Or are you seeing some bumps along the road?
This is a hard question. I don't want to do the typecasting about who is the SOR movement and who's not. So I'm not sure.
Well, that's fair. That's an honest answer. Judy, any other questions on your list before I let it rip?
Christopher, are you hopeful about you know, I know we're talking a lot about FMP and Fontas and Pinnell and Lucy and all the problems. Are you hopeful that I got to take a sip of my seltzer? Thanks, Faith. Are you hopeful about the state of literacy? Because I know it's going to be bumpy for a little while, and I hope that, you know, people can embrace the bumpy ride. Are you hopeful that we're going to get things right this time as a nation, as a country, as a world?
I hope so. I am optimistic, and I think we have a lot of people who did their training. Like I think Faith did with reading first and have this background, and they saw how that went awry about when you have these conflicts of interest with publishers, and that leads to these hearings on Capitol Hill, and people feel like it's being forced down their throats. So I think we've learned some lessons about that, and there does seem to be just genuine energy out there of like, I really want to learn about the science. And I think the hardest part's going to be about giving time to learn and adjust practices and understand why you're doing it before we dive into, here's the next thing. Okay, I bought a new curriculum, and oh shoot, now I got to go focus on my history instruction or whatever and get that right, or whatever the latest new fad is. I think that's a real worry that we just check off the box, say, okay, we dealt with that literacy thing, and then 10 years from now, we're back having the exact same conversation again. But I do think that there are some people who are educating themselves and really learning that. I think this time is, I hope, different, but the
literacy
might mess with the timeline that people really need to let it sink in.
And I think that you hit on an interesting point, Christopher. I think, you know, so many new programs are coming out, but I've been saying this for a while, and I think Faith would agree with me, I hope, is that pedagogy and understanding what we're doing, why we're doing it, and how we're doing it is such a key component that regardless of whatever program you're using, there's things that we know based on the evidence is working, and investing in our teachers and our leaders, like Faith said, is such an important piece of the puzzle. So like online, sometimes people go nuts. Oh, it's all about just curriculum. It's all about programs. No, it's also about pedagogy and that teacher knowledge.
Mm-hmm.
And no, I would agree. Yes.
It's just like chicken and egg thing too. Sometimes we get criticized for focusing too much on programs, but I think they just go together. So I don't want someone to say, well, we replaced the program, or oh, we just, you know, did letters training and that's it. Because I do think in the absence of ongoing training, sometimes the curriculum does become your guide. These little intros to the chapter, you know, what teaches you, and you go to the teacher next door and say, hey, how are you approaching this? So it gives some structure to the classroom. And I think that does lead to some influential ideas, and especially when it gets in the intervention room, the assessments, and that becomes kind of just the way you're supposed to do things. And especially if you get training on those specific programs too. So I think you can't, all these levers have to change together, and can't pull them all at once. So I just hope that we have enough time to really let things stick in and start to see results and realize where we're not getting results and adjust along the way too, because there's not just one answer of, oh, I started doing more systematic phonics instruction, we're all said and done. That might get you some higher scores in your first couple of Dibbles tests, but that doesn't necessarily mean that your fifth graders are better readers either. So there's just so many levers that we have to focus on. I hope we don't get too myopic, and then we let people have the space and time to really adjust along the way and learn.
So it's interesting what you said, Christopher. We had a guest on, Maureen Ruby, and she talked about curriculum. And she had said basically recently, Connecticut came out with their blueprint, a curriculum blueprint. And I think what you're saying is that a program could inform really good instruction, right? If you see it in a program, it can inform good instruction, but you can't do it without sustained teacher, professional development and building that teacher knowledge. So here's my question. I want to know about these laws, the legislation. Like, what do you think? Do you think this is something that is necessary? Do you think it's going to work? Do you think in 5-10 years that people are going to say, all right, so we have this law, it didn't really do very much? Just curious about your thoughts.
I don't think the laws alone are going to do much, because it was interesting when I was looking at all these new rafts of legislation is sometimes they were just updating a law from the 1990s or early 2000s, and they replaced what was then the term that was in vogue, like evidence-based instruction or something like that, with now saying science of reading. So they actually even had all these structures in place. They even said, you know, here's the big five that everyone needs to cover. And they just took out, instead of evidence-based, now as research, scientific, you know, reading research-based, which is not even that new, you could argue too. So a law itself is not going to do much. I do think that some of these laws that are banning teaching based on 3Qing can be helpful in dislodging some of these ineffective or even harmful practices from classrooms that have been so stuck in there. And that was maybe one of the reasons why Reading First didn't get as far as it needed to, because everyone said, well, we were teaching phonics and we added that in, so what's the big deal? We all agreed on that. But there was this other idea that was there that need to be dislodged. So I think that's helpful. And hopefully it comes with investment. I think that's the other thing too, is that you're asking teachers to put time into all this relearning, to change their views, to adjust to a new program. It's a lot, and it's only going to work if there is money behind it to actually support schools through that transition. So some states are better than others in doing that, of actually having beefing up their State Department of Ed support staff and getting people into schools to help them shepherd them along the transition, and paying for all these new materials, paying for the training. I think that could go a long way. But just changing, putting in saying, okay, everyone's got to teach phonics now, I don't think that that's going to be the lever that we need.
Faith, but it's getting even more specific than that. It's, I think that the laws are actually saying names of specific programs. Yes, no?
I saw one bill that was doing that. I think it was in Wisconsin or Minnesota. But didn't, that version didn't get passed. Oh. But there are places maybe that are saying, here's the specific professional development that you need to get. I think Letters had some bills passed that were like that.
Well, I'm having deja vu because, as you know, I was part of Reading First. I was a regional reading coach with Reading First, and then I was the project manager for Early Reading First. And so, you know, that was part of, you know, my background. And I was actually practicing, as you said, SBRR, science-based reading research, using that for my instruction. And that's my story. So you mentioned how things go wrong. And I'm seeing, Christopher, because that was over 20 years ago. And, you know, I've been at this for a long time, and I'm having deja vu. Like, all of these things that are being talked about now, the lawsuit, the reading recovery lawsuit. Well, for a lot of people out there who are much younger, there was a reading recovery lawsuit during Reading First times. Okay. And it was the same type of thing where people were fighting this, saying that, you know, all these initiatives were, you know, I don't know how you would say it, against not unconstitutional. I don't.
Yeah,
I'm not
unethical at the least. Corrupt, maybe at the worst. Yeah, and that complaint was what kind of helped bring things down.
Right, and so, and then we went right back. And now Judy also mentioned during this how it was 2013 where this was all coming in. But I hate to say it, Judy. Back, you turn the clock back. And before that, this was happening, you know, so there was this ebb and flow from the time 1990s, where the research really started to catch on, into the Bush era and No Child Left Behind, where all of these types of things were coming in, this evidence. But then it was like we forgot about it. It's like the balanced literacy movement came back stronger than ever. And as you said, Christopher, the item in numbers in 2019 only were astronomical. Like, they were on top after all this Reading First stuff and after we had SBRR around for a long time. People don't realize that this evidence didn't just happen a few years ago. This has been going on for a long time, but because these special interest groups are so powerful, it got buried And now it's like all of this is coming back again. That's why I say deja vu. Judy, any last questions or thoughts for
Christopher? All right, I have a couple. I'm going to be fast. I circled them, Christopher. Okay, so this is a breaking news episode. If we promote it, are you okay with me putting you on a mountain peak?
That's how I introduce myself right. Whenever I'm on phone calls to people. It's peak like mountaintop. So,
no problem?
No problem.
All right, good. No pressure. All right. Also,
she's, by the way, she has dolphin energy. And if you ever see the very cute graphics, it's all Judy. It is not me. I do the right
thing. Thanks, Faith. So when people complain about being in top form, I can't.
It's true. I mean, she does all the little cutesy Instagrams and stuff. She's great.
It soothes my anxiety. All right. Also, Christopher, favorite podcasts that do not relate to literacy? Any of them out there that you enjoy?
Oh my God, there's so many. But one of my ultimate favorites and the reason why I love working at APM Reports is my former colleagues who did the show In the Dark. That's just some of the best reporting out there. And they, I think, have a new season coming soon. It's now with The New Yorker. But in particular, there's season 2 about this guy, Curtis Flowers, who was tried for the same crime. I can't remember if it was like 5 or 6 times. And they, spoiler alert, ended up getting him off and convincing the Supreme Court that that this person was innocent. And it's just such a moving podcast. So I have to pump them up because that was just one of the things that really got me in love with podcasts to begin with.
Awesome. Awesome. I'm definitely expanding my podcast listening as well. Favorite hobbies. Where am I going to find Christopher when he's not reporting?
I do a lot of cooking, and I used to, when I was in New Haven, I want to get back into it, is doing pottery.
That's very soothing. So cool. That is so cool.
Because you can't think about anything else. You can't look at your phone. You're just on the wheel, throwing your pots, and it's its own kind of meditation.
Two more tiny questions, I promise. Christopher, when you were being raised as a little boy, what was the literacy program in your school?
I switched schools in kindergarten. So I can't remember. I went to Catholic schools. I know I've been trying to figure this out. I just remember I couldn't spell my name because Christopher is kind of a hard name to spell. So I just put CP on all my papers through kindergarten. But I don't know what they, used to teach. My mom had Dick and Jane books at home in the bathroom.
That's how I learned Dick and Jane. That's what they had when I went to school.
I don't know if I learned from it, but they were in the bathroom for my whole childhood.
I am.
They were in the bathroom.
I was the bathroom reader.
It could really be, Christopher. Your mom probably is around the same age as me. Because the chat's how she learned from Dick and Jane. I learned from Dick and Jane.
When's your mom's birthday? Is it in April?
She's 2 days ago.
We did not ask this question before. That is
hilarious. This is definitely the last one. This is definitely the last one. All right, Christopher, one last one. Do you see this as just another pendulum swing, or do you think that we're going to see this?
I hope not. And maybe what we were talking about earlier about the typecasting, I hope that we're able to recognize what some of the problems were with our old way of doing things. We focused very narrowly on this one idea about the importance of, you know, words and getting kids to decode them, and that you don't need these other workarounds and shortcuts to get kids to be able to pull words off the page. But that's just half of the equation. And so I hope that we're able to recognize what the research has said and has said for decades and move on from some of these discredited and disproven ideas. But then also that those people had other things that were right and that need to be part of the conversation, and that there's a synthesis of that, that we don't, you know, I'm writing these articles about the publishing company that had these discredited ideas really are suffering. And you could argue about whether they deserve that or not, but not everything that Heinemann put out was entirely wrong. And those people do have ideas that need to be part of the conversation. And people who are on the other side have things to learn from them too. So I hope Hope this
can
is
I
not
give Christopher it. Cheers? He has not gotten one cheers. He deserves like 35.
Yes,
thank you.
I cheered.
Where's your cheers button?
I will cheer now, right now.
But then right. We move on from the wars. It needs to be, we're on the same team fundamentally, which is about advancing kids' education. And so I hope we can get past that framing once we remove some of these ideas that have been so incorrect and have been, I think, a distraction. And if we do that, then I think we can move on together and learn from each other and get this right. That's not just about getting kids to decode, or it's not just about teaching kids comprehension strategies. They have to do everything. And everyone has something to teach each other.
So here's a couple of questions for you, and then we'll wrap up. So, you know, I'm thinking in terms of these universities, Heinemann Publishing, the people in your article, Lucy, Fontes, and Pinnell. Do you think that they didn't know about the evidence? I just said before, this has been around a long time. And, you know, they dug their heels in and stayed the course. But now I think, you know, they have to change because it's so much of a bigger topic with the internet. You know, things are very different from how they were during, you know, reading first days. But I mean, do you really think they were in the dark? I'll use your podcast, In the Dark. Do you think they were in the dark, really, about the evidence that existed? Christopher, what are your thoughts about that?
We were careful with that and sold a story because I personally don't know. But I think what we, the way we decided to phrase it was that they should have known. I think that's a very fair case to make. If you're putting out some of the most popular curricula that American elementary schools are using, if you're really dictating the way that a lot of people do assessments and do these running records, and you have MSV as the coding on there, at a certain point, they should have known. I think that's what we can say.
I would say so. If you're part of an Ivy League university or any university system and you're a publisher for school districts, it's your job, again, to keep up with the research. Last question, I promise. Okay. Did you have a chance to interview anyone that you thought really had the inside scoop, who really gave you some good information out there? If you could name one person, or the three top people who you thought were most helpful to you in your reporting.
Oh gosh, I don't even know if I can do that, because we interviewed like, just for Sold a Story, is about like 125 people between Emily and me.
I want spicy, Christopher.
Spicy.
Yes, yeah, something spicy.
That's spicy, like a hot oil pizza.
And God, and then I had my off the record conversation, so I can't even.
Sally's Pizza.
those are probably the spiciest ones, but those are off the record. I know that's too hard to do. I don't want to.
Okay. All right. Again, being a little bit cryptic here.
I know. Sorry. But there's just so much information out there, and I don't want to say that anyone has the answers to, because I think that is a little dangerous. So, but we really were aided by so many people along the way, and you hear a lot of them in the podcast, and you don't hear from even scores more of them who were so informative. And it's nice that there's so much information that's accessible out there. I knew like nothing about literacy 4 years ago, and I've been taught so much by so many people. So I don't want to just pick out my three idols, but there are many.
Okay. Could you at least tell us, instead of people, what was most helpful to you in your reporting? Could you do that in terms of?
Yes. Probably the thing, I'd read a couple books early on, and the first one that was very helpful was David Kilpatrick's, what's it called? The assessing, preventing, that one for young reader for reading difficulties, because that was the first one.
Yeah.
What's that book called?
Yes. I don't remember the exact name, but Preventing and Assessing for Reading Difficulties, something, to that effect. And the essentials, there was the essentials book as well.
Yeah. So that one was the most helpful. I'd read some other books before that were a little bit more about the cognitive science research, which is dense. And it's all about, you know, how are alphabets structured and what does that have to do with our evolutionary history? And then they get into which lobe is doing what and the brain's letterbox. And I was like, oh my gosh, what does this actually mean for our project of looking at how teachers are teaching? And that was one of the first books that I feel like really helped connect some of the dots of how it relates to classroom instruction and what you're looking for when you're intervening. I'm a little hesitant to recommend it too highly because I think he has changed his mind on some things. And the book has as long as you read it, knowing that there is this important idea of having a very good sense of phonemic awareness, but that doesn't necessarily need to be taught. I think the research he points out about why we need to be able to, hear and segment and blend all these sounds and words is important, but maybe that doesn't mean that you need to necessarily teach it. So you just have to have that in the back of your mind as you're reading that book. But otherwise, I thought that was helpful to just kind of get from some of these more theoretical books I've been reading to what does that mean for a teacher? How does orthographic mapping relate to what you're looking for when you're actually starting to assess kids?
Wow, Christopher, you definitely went beyond your Dick and Jane books. So you read in the bathroom.
So books for you gave you your background in being able to help with your investigative reporting. What about research articles?
A ton of those, yes.
Okay, great.
Yeah.
Did we not cover anything that you would like to add?
I'm not sure if we did. I think, yeah, the one other thing we noticed in this, as Heinemann's going down, there are a lot of new publishers coming up and filling the void. Maybe I just have thoughts about those, but I got access to this database, GovSpend, that is kind of the most comprehensive look you can get at where school districts are spending their money. So you can see Heinemann sales just completely go down. They're down by about 75% from their peak just a couple of years ago, peak, so to speak. But there's a bunch of other publishers that are now experiencing this just off the charts trajectory of growth, like Amplify, Great Minds with Wit and Wisdom, these newer ones that have kind of a nonprofit with a publisher behind them, like EL Education or ViewFly Materials. So that was just interesting to see where that money is going instead that Heinemann used to be picking up. And interestingly too, I thought there'd be a bigger share going to the Basel programs that you hear a lot about, but it didn't seem like they're picking up as much money as I expected from how much you hear about them. But there are a lot of people who are turning to these knowledge building curricula.
And I think we wonder how that's going to go because, even though the knowledge building is quite important, do we know that these programs have the evidence that, in every aspect of it, I guess time will tell. And even as far as, the Reading League coming out with their evaluation reports, it's all about implementation, right? And how carefully that's done. And someone just put something out on Twitter, Elizabeth, what's her last name? Renster? I don't know. She's a big person on Twitter. I follow her too. And she-
Renstra.
Oh, thank you. Yeah, I love her posts. And she just put something out and I kind of retweeted something she said, that it's all really about the time, the investment in implementation, the coaching, the time, the knowledge building to make this work. So I guess time will tell. Okay, well, thank you, Christopher Peek. And those articles, again, could be found, and all the links will be in the show notes for APM Reports, Christopher Peek. Under his profile, but anybody who wants to look at the separate articles, it was, again, April 4th, as states refocus reading instruction, two universities stick with a discredited idea. April 11th, Reading Recovery Organization confronts financial difficulties. And April 30th, and that's the latest one, Science of Reading Movement spells financial trouble for publisher Heinemann. Wishing your mom a happy birthday. She could be part thank of our you. Birthday club, the April Birthday Club. And thank you so much for being here and taking time.
Well, thank you.
At this with us.
And there's two new bonus episodes. Actually, I think we renumbered them now. So it's episodes 9 and 10 for Sold a Story, where we go through a lot of this about what's happened to these big players. And also, Emily asked some very good questions about what are the issues we need to be thinking about going forward, especially this idea about how much explicit teaching do you need to do, that she talks with Mark Seidenberg and Reed Lyon about. So check those out if you haven't already, because they go cover some of the same ground as these articles.
I have to say Reed Lyon was one of my heroes in reading first. That's how far back, you know, he goes in terms of this type of research. So I am looking forward to that. Thank you so much. Judy, hit it, how people could get in touch with us.
All right. Thank you, Christopher. We loved having you on Literacy View. Thank you for everything you do. You could follow us on theliteracyview.com. That's our webpage, newly designed. Everything is there. You know where to find us. We're on Twitter, Faces, Faith Twitter, my Twitter, Instagram, The Literacy View. And till next time, one changing lives, one view at a time.
Great. TheLiteracyView.com. Thank you, everyone. And thank you, Christopher.
Thank you.